I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th of May. Hope everyone had a terrific Mother's Day yesterday, and here we are ready to go with all things political, which you always hear Mondays at 1 o'clock. Jonathan Allen is our guest this hour. Jonathan is senior political correspondent for Vox. He was Bloomberg News Washington Bureau Chief, and he also worked at Politico as senior Washington correspondent and also at Congressional Quarterly. He's the co-author of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. And he's written a lot of articles about Hillary Clinton, including one today in which he invites us to meet the man behind hawkish Hillary Clinton's foreign policy, Jake Sullivan. He's written that Hillary's move to the left could help her win the general election. He writes about Carly Fiorina running as an outsider who can fix big D.C. problems, but her ideas are small. What Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton told us with their responses to Baltimore, Bernie Sanders' ideas so popular that Hillary Clinton is running on them. We'll talk about the Clinton Foundation. We'll talk about Marco Rubio. And an interesting piece he wrote late in April, "This isn't your Tea Party's Congress. Washington is working again, and that's because it's now in Mitch McConnell's interest to make that happen." We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jonathan during the course of this hour, so whatever is on your mind when it comes to political news, feel free to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, leave your messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Jonathan Allen, hello. Thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Thanks for having me. Sounds like you're going to keep me on my toes this afternoon.
Well, you're always on your toes. That's why we invite you, right? You're a guy who's on his toes. Let's start with what you wrote about today, Jake Sullivan. And I'm interested in what Hillary Clinton has said on the campaign so far about her foreign policy. You title it, "Meet the Man Behind Hawkish Hillary Clinton's Foreign Policy, Jake Sullivan." A pretty young guy, huh?
Yeah, he's 38 at moment. Birthday's in November, so it'll be a while before he's 39. He worked at the State Department as the Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy and also ran the State Department's in-house policy think tank. Before that, though, he was basically the debate prep guy for Hillary Clinton in 2008, and he did such a good job of it that the Obama people borrowed him for Obama's debate prep against John McCain after the primary was over. So he's a guy who's at a very young age. I mean, back then he was, I think, 31, very well-regarded inside the Democratic establishment.
So what is the thrust of her foreign policy when it comes to campaigning? Is she's considered hawkish. Do you still consider her hawkish, and has she made statements that confirm that?
Yeah, certainly within the context of the Democratic Party, she's much more hawkish than the anti-war left, and I'd say even a broader group than sort of reflexive anti-war left, but people who are just kind of tired of American wars, whether it's the latest Iraq war in 2003 or Libya, or the extent to which we have engaged in some other places at a lesser level around the world. She has not been talking about foreign policy so far. Doesn't really behoove her to talk a lot about foreign policy during the Democratic primary stretch, because that's just a place where the base of the party doesn't necessarily agree with her. I think she believes that she takes a nuanced view of foreign policy problems that you should have in your basket of potential responses, everything from giving foreign aid to try to entice countries to do what you want them to do, or using military force to coerce them to do that, and sometimes use them in conjunction. And so this piece on Jake Sullivan sort of goes through that that smart power philosophy, which is sort of a philosophical, actually. It's sort of, do this, if I were to boil it down, I would say do all the smart things that you can do, not one or the other. But it is something that I think is going to upset some of the people in the Democratic Party about her. And, she was an advocate for a variety of military interventions while she was in the State Department, for better and worse. The raid to go after Osama bin Laden, that's something she was in favor of. The Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, had some misgivings about it. Vice President Joe Biden was against it. But also the Libya intervention, which ultimately knocked Muammar Gaddafi out of power, but we see now that Libya is pretty chaotic. I think that the jury's still out on that.
Wouldn't you think that, and wouldn't she think that because she was Secretary of State that we would expect her to speak in a very detailed fashion about how she's going to take on terrorism?
Yeah, you would think that would happen at some point. It doesn't sound to me like she feels like there's a real need to do that right now. And one of the dangers of talking about foreign policy is that dynamics change over time. So the earlier you get out and start saying what you would do in X country or Y country, that policy may look very outdated within a couple of months. She wants to be in the right place for the general election in October or November of 2016. Being right today could mean being wrong tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. We'll get back to her in a moment. Jeb Bush evidently said over the weekend that he would have done the same thing his brother did when it came to invading Iraq. Does it behoove him to say that? Would that be a politically popular stance to take when it comes to the Republicans, or is that problematic?
There's a huge problem. There's a division within the Republican Party. If he says that it was a mistake, it's destructive to him and to his brother's legacy. And at the same time, if he says he would do the same thing, if you're the political opponent, either in the Republican primary or at the general election level, you start saying, well, geez, another Bush, another Iraq war. We had two under the first two Bushes, and I think that's going to be difficult to sell right now. But I think he, faced with a bad choice of rejecting his brother accepting the Iraq war, decided that it was worse to throw his brother under the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And also, that's not to discount the likelihood that he believes what he said.
Well, we would hope that he would. You want your politicians to say believable things, right?
Correct. You want them to tell you what they believe and what they would do.
Exactly. Let's hear the truth. You wrote an interesting piece, what Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton told us with their responses to Baltimore. What did they tell us?
So Hillary Clinton's response was, let's end the era of mass incarceration. Let's put body cameras on in police offices all over the country. I think this was very much a rejection of her president's tough-on-crime stances in the 1990s. And it was a sign that she sees this issue as one that can benefit her not only in the primary but in the general election, that there's enough support for reforming sentencing laws and putting body cameras on people among Republicans that it's not going to hurt her to do that. This is a play to her base. It's a good time to do it. I think she thinks it won't cost her a whole lot. Same thing with Bush. His response was a new welfare reform law. And that sort of is Republican Party orthodoxy, saying, hey, look, we did some welfare reform in the 1990s. Bill Clinton thought it worked. Hillary Clinton thought it worked, at least to some degree. And maybe what we should be doing now is a welfare reform program aimed at men, because the first reforms were really aimed at single mothers. So now you're looking at a problem from that perspective. Of do something with young men, impoverished young men. That's popular in the Republican Party, particularly when it comes to, tough on crime stance. There's no loss there. He's not alienating minorities who are already voting for Republicans. The percentage of minorities voting for Republicans is very, very small.
Mm-hmm. And does Hillary Clinton hope to get a substantial number of minority voters, particularly African Americans, to the polls with the comments that she made about mass incarceration, about the haves and the have-nots, about body cameras? And if so, will she be able to be successful?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. In order to win election, I think she has to keep together Barack Obama's coalition as much as possible. So part of that is signaling to core Democratic constituencies that were not necessarily with her in 2008, that she will be a champion for the things that they care about. And so this is one opportunity to do some outreach with low downside risk, and I think some high upside in terms of signaling early that you're with a constituency.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, the Republicans have so many candidates, you can't keep track of them all now.
Like a tour bus.
It is, isn't it?
then I think it's that field is only going to grow. I think that's. There's a point at which it becomes a little ridiculous, but I think we'll get a good debate. We'll get some good arguments. Within the Republican primary, whoever comes out of that will be pretty battle tested.
I think maybe she wanted to be the Republican counterpart to Hillary Clinton, but you write about Carly Fiorina as being an outsider who says she can fix D.C., but you call her ideas small.
Yeah, the things that she talked about the other day in her announcement were very, and I'm blanking a little bit on some of the specifics, but I just recall they were very sort of narrow cast what it was she had proposed doing. It wasn't like there was this big vision for how she wanted to come into Washington and clean it up. It was very narrow cast.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think she would be running?
Well, I think let's take her word that she's running for president because she wants to be president. She thinks she would be the best president. But in addition to that, I think there's an opportunity here potentially to get put on the Republican ticket, and that's no small thing to go out there and be a vice presidential candidate, potentially vice president of the United States. I think it is unlikely you will see her saying things about fellow Republicans that would deny her the ability to be on the ticket.
Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders bringing in a lot of money from just regular people, $45, $50. You say that his ideas are so popular that Hillary Clinton is running on them. How about that?
Well, we've seen a big shift to the left from her, particularly on economic policy and the way she talks about it, going after CEOs, talking about corporate tax cuts being bad, particularly for companies that ship jobs overseas. You've seen her embrace a constitutional amendment on campaign finance reform. These are all things that sound very Bernie Sanders-like, and I think what she's doing is trying to make it difficult for someone to run a serious bid to her left.
Well, it's going to be extremely hard for anybody to run any kind of a campaign, any Democrat or socialist or whatever, against her, isn't it? It would appear that she just got the money, and it's holding true what we were saying quite some time ago, that she is she's the candidate.
The key is that the vast majority of the Democratic Party is comfortable with her.
Mm.
So if you're somebody who's trying to run against her and you look at polling and it says 89% of liberals approve of her, you're trying to figure out where you're going to run to her. You're going to run center against her, and nobody's going to do that effectively because the party's moved pretty far left. So I think she's squeezed out a lot of the space for somebody else to run. And last time, she was happy to talk about foreign policy issues. I think it's something that matters to Democratic voters, but I don't think it's as big of a motivator as some of the domestic issues, particularly economic issues.
Right. Well, foreign policy certainly should be. It's front and present, isn't it, all the time?
It is, but that doesn't necessarily mean folks pay attention to it or could really figure it out on their own. I think, one of the things she's banking on is that Democrats in particular, and probably some independents, will give her the benefit of the doubt of being somebody who is somewhat capable on foreign policy, and that she can spend her time talking about issues that divide Republicans and unify Democrats instead of the other way around.
Let's talk a little bit more about the foundation problems that she has and what may yet be dug up concerning those problems. You've written about the Clinton Foundation donors who lobbied Hillary's State Department. Do you think there's a lot there that has yet to be discovered that's going to create severe problems for her, Jonathan?
I think those are separate questions. I do think that there's more there, but whether it's something that rises to the level of corruption or illegal behavior, nobody's suggested that. People have spent a lot of hours. I've spent a lot of hours digging through some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
There's no suggestion of a quid pro quo between a donor and the Clinton Foundation and what Hillary Clinton was doing at state. That said, I think, reasonably most people look at who's donating what to whom and what public policy decisions are at least coincidental to that, and they worry about a small group of special interests having particular access or particular ability to affect public policy. Again, we haven't seen that yet. So we're still going to be talking about the Clinton Foundation a year from now. The question is whether anybody will find anything that is more damning than the Clintons are too close to their donors.
Jonathan Allen is our guest for All Things Political this Monday, and we welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. We're talking a lot about Hillary Clinton because he knows a lot about her. He's the co-author of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. He, as well as our guest last week, talked about Hillary giving one of the most important speeches of her career when she talked about mass incarceration and her response to Baltimore and police cameras on all officers. We can ask you to give your response to her response to Baltimore, Jeb Bush's response to Baltimore. Would you agree that foreign policy is something that we're just not thinking very much about and that domestic concerns are much more top of mind for you as you look at this presidential race? Or would you pay close attention to what a candidate's foreign policy concerns may be? I have yet, and I think this is an interesting piece that Jonathan wrote, that Washington is working again. Who said that lately? He says it's because it is now in the best interest of Mitch McConnell to make that happen. So what can we expect from Congress in the months ahead as more and more time is devoted to the election? We will go on to talk about Rand Paul, Governor Scott Walker, who is in Israel now. We'll talk about his trip there. It seemed as though maybe a month ago his name was being circulated and talked about much more than it is right now. Are we seeing some other favorite emerge at this point in time? Well, we'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number. And let's go to April in the Twin Cities. Hi, April.
Hi.
Go ahead, April.
Oh, hi. Sorry, I just wanted to have your opinion on why black men were portrayed as, like, brutal criminals in the media in the 70s up to the 90s, and why black men are now being portrayed as victims of police brutality mostly. And I was wondering what that change was, if you had any opinions on that.
Well, I think it depends on who's doing the portraying. I think there's still an element of our society that they see a black man arrested who ends up getting killed by a police officer. Their assumption is that the black man did something wrong, and in so many of these cases we're seeing either that somebody didn't do anything wrong or that they did something that, like, you know, was so far from meriting the kind of force used against them as to kind of appall our conscience. At the same time, I think, we are seeing the bubbling up of some long-held frustrations about police brutality in communities across the country. I don't think that's necessarily something that's limited to particular racial minorities in terms of being on the receiving end, although my guess is that it is, much worse. Not only my guess, there's all sorts of evidence to show that, but I think that we are coming to grips with, as a society, some of our prejudices and some of our, sort of long-held deep suspicions about each other, and it's been ugly so far.
It sure has been ugly. Well, it wasn't that long ago, and it lasted for quite some time, Jonathan, didn't it? The three strikes, you're out. We put many, many people, nonviolent offenders as well, in our prisons. They were bursting at the seams, and maybe it was because of some financial concerns that states couldn't keep up with the amount of money they had to spend to keep so many people in prison. That was partially the reason. But then, of course, these much publicized cases about serious problems with police in minority communities. But to take the first part first, we kind of gave up on that throw everybody in prison philosophy.
Well, I think we're giving up on it. I don't know if I would go so far as to say we gave up on it. The 1994 crime bill that Bill Clinton pushed did several things, including upping the number of police officers in the streets, including pushing states to have harsher sentences for various crimes, basically tying some of their federal prison money to that, building more and bigger prisons, three strikes, you're out law that was mentioned. you know, all of those things in combination, I think, led to what Hillary Clinton appropriately called the era of mass incarceration. And I think we're just starting in the last few years to see some real push on sentencing reform to basically say if you get caught with, a dime bag of weed, you shouldn't be in prison for 30 years, right. Particularly at a time when so many of our states are passing marijuana laws, or, you know, whatever the thing is. If you're talking about nonviolent offenders, putting them away for 10, 20, 30 years could be very counterproductive. By the time they get out, they're more likely to be recidivists.
Why is it that we talk about some of these issues? We look at the rate of unemployment in minority communities, particularly African-American men, and it's in Baltimore, I understand. Over half the population doesn't have a job. You look at the importance of having a job in your life. You get up and you go to work and you have some money and you have some sense of self-worth. Why is it that we talk about how we need jobs for people, we need to bring jobs to inner cities, on and on and on and on, and yet I don't see anybody with a really comprehensive plan to enact this, nor do I see Congress coming up with money to put together a program that would rebuild the infrastructure or whatever it's going to be. But don't you think jobs is a big part of a solution here?
I do, but I think it's more complicated than just that. That is to say, there are jobs available. Maybe not in a particular year or in a particular month in a particular region, but the level of unemployment in our cities among men does not comport with, it's way out of balance with the lack of availability of jobs. That is to say, jobs are there. The question is, do folks want to do them? And, but beyond that, which is here's a bigger question, which is, if you've been to prison because police are cracking down more, then it makes it harder for you to get a job, and particularly to get a job that pays well. So I think there are a lot of pieces of this solution, and it can be easy to make it too simple.
Yeah, it can be easy to make it too simple, but it sure is hard to do anything about it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, I think if somebody could wave their hand and fix things, I think they would. The approach 20 years ago was to put everybody in jail. We see that has not worked.
Right.
But that has been counterproductive. So, public policy ideas are often a lot better on a piece of paper than they are in practice, and we've seen some real failure of our policy there.
Here's an email. Somebody wanting to know your opinion of Scott Walker's foreign policy at Freedom Fest this past weekend in South Carolina. Walker's comments on terrorism, it's not a matter of if, but when another attempt is made on American soil, and then the New York Times reporting that he launched into the line that got him his biggest standing ovation of the day. I want a leader who is willing to take the fight to them before they take the fight to us.
It's so easy that you can boil it down to 6 or 7 words, apparently. Take the fight to them instead of here. Well, obviously nobody wants a fight with terrorists in the United States. I think that he's still trying to feel out what his foreign policy would be. I mean, he's never dealt with foreign policy in any real way as governor of Wisconsin. I mean, maybe he's got some capacity to call out the National Guard if he has to, but let's be serious. He hasn't come in here with Henry Kissinger's background, which may be a good thing too. So I think from my perspective, I think we're going to have to wait a little bit longer and hear a little bit more from him specifically about what he would do with particular partners and enemies of the United States.
Mm-hmm. You don't hear his name as much as you did a few weeks ago, maybe because he was making a lot of speeches and he's in Israel right now. He still evidently is pulling very well in Iowa. Do you imagine him to have a pretty happy primary season?
Well, I think he's got a good shot in Iowa, and I think one of the reasons you haven't heard so much from him is intentional. I think, you don't want to be the flavor of the month in the Republican primary a year and a half out. You want to be the flavor of the month on Election Day. So I think he's still trying to put together a campaign, and I think that's smart. I think it's particularly for somebody who doesn't have a lot of foreign policy experience, national security experience, to be able to make sure you're really well-versed in the issues, so when you do come out, you're less likely to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Gene in Stillwater. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Well, you know, I just think it's really interesting. Anytime anybody brings up these serious questions about Hillary Clinton or all of the things that have gone on in her past, we demonize these people as some sort of conspiracy theorists. You know, we demonize them, we marginalize them, we criticize them, and we don't take any of their questions seriously. And, you know, you just look at the things Hillary Clinton's done over the years, like voting for the Iraq War, or the fact that she was on the board of Walmart, or the fact that she was kicked off of the Watergate investigation for being unethical, and just the way that the Democrats, and I am a Democrat, but the way that the Democrats just ignore everything that's wrong with her past just because she's a Democrat. It just proves that, you know, a lot of the Democrats in this country, they're just not any better than the Republicans. I mean, the Clintons just have a horrible, horrible track record. You got to look into what they were doing when Bill was governor of Arkansas and how they were helping Bush Sr. bring cocaine into the country. It's just disgusting, the things they've been doing, you know. They're terrible, terrible people.
Jonathan.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, I do think that what the Clintons are very good at is quickly polarizing people. So if there's some knock on them, they're very good at quickly making it about us, or, you know, you're with us or you're against us. And that has the effect in the Democratic Party of bringing people to their side. So I think that, you know, I think we're going to continue to see that through this election up until the time where, you know, Democrats feel like they can't be with her anymore. I don't think they're there yet.
And I think you need to respond to they were with the Bushes in bringing cocaine into this country.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of conspiracy theories around that. I don't put much stock in the idea that the presidents of the United States are attempting to infiltrate our cities and fill our cities with drugs.
Yeah.
So my response to that would be like, come on.
Mitch McConnell, let's move to which, you know, who's heard this in the last 6 months, if not the last several years? This is not your Tea Party's Congress. Washington is working again. It is?
It is a little bit. I mean, I think we saw some legislation moving. We saw Loretta Lynch, the nominee for Attorney General, get confirmed by the Senate. That wasn't supposed to happen. We saw a sex trafficking bill passed that wasn't supposed to happen. We've seen a few instances where the two parties have come together, and I think what's going on here is that Mitch McConnell is in need of some victories to show that Republicans can govern. And Barack Obama also, with his legacy up in the air, you know, at least still trying to tack some things onto that, he also wants to get some things done.
Mm-hmm. You have a baby?
My son is three, and we're both homesick today, and I'm so sorry about the extra noise. It was unanticipated.
So you're trying to do an interview, and you're sick, and he's sick, and you got your hands full.
So my deep apologies to you.
It's okay. No, it's fine. We didn't even know any of it until I heard in the background somebody who sounded unhappy. Jonathan Allen is our guest, and we're welcoming phone calls for all things political. He talked about Loretta Lynch and the sex trafficking bill passed. It's amazing to me, though, how little seems to be getting done in Washington. I can mention a few things, but aren't they there to be passing some bills and dealing with some issues? Would you agree that we're seeing just a little bit of progress now because it's in the interest of Mitch McConnell to do so? We're talking, of course, a lot about the campaign, about Hillary Clinton, about Scott Walker, about Jeb Bush. We have not yet talked about Marco Rubio, so we'll go to him next. And Jonathan writes that he's found the perfect message against both Jeb and Hillary. What is that message? But first, let me invite you to join our conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. It's still early, but when you look at the kinds of issues that you would like the current Congress to be addressing, and all of the people, all of the many people who are running for president in 2016, what's on that list of yours? What are the most pressing problems? Do we need to pay more attention to foreign policy? Is somebody giving you a clear picture of how he or she would take on terrorism in the world? What are the most pressing domestic issues that somebody should be paying attention to now? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And our guest this hour is Jonathan Allen. Jonathan is senior political correspondent for Vox. He was before that at Bloomberg News as Washington Bureau Chief. He's been at Politico and also at Congressional Quarterly. He is the co-author of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. And let's go next to Suzanne in Galena. Hi, Suzanne. Suzanne, want to turn your radio down, please? Hi, Suzanne.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Enjoying the conversation very much. And my question for your guest is about the about Hillary Clinton's health. There's been general concern about how robust she is, and it seems that the Secretary of State is the kind of job that in 4 years would age you about 20. And now she's going to run for president. Just kind of wondering if she's up to the challenge and if your guest has thoughts on the matter.
Do you see her as being less than robust now, Suzanne?
Well, she's not doing a lot on the ground, you know. She's not out glad-handing a lot. And I think there's a physical intensity that her husband had, that he met people in small towns everywhere. I mean, he could not shake enough hands. He could not meet enough people in person.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be a, you know, maybe it's early yet, but she's not pressing the flesh much. And I wonder how robust her flesh is.
All right, Jonathan.
You know, I think it's always worth examining whether presidential candidates are people that you think have the strength to do the job. It is a grueling job. You know, I think my observation of her over the last few years is that she's actually been fairly active. I think most of us, if we had the kind of schedule she does, would feel pretty tired at the end of the day. And I haven't seen a lot to suggest that she's run down since, you know, she fainted at her house. I had a blood clot in her brain, as it turned out, or near her brain. So, you know, I don't see it as a, but I think voters will vote on it if they see it, if they see that she's not up to the task. You know, I think that's perhaps one of the first, you know, one or two questions about whether you would vote for somebody.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine. That seems, that Secretary of State job, to fly like that from country to country, food to food, water to water, culture to culture. My goodness, what a difficult job that must be. Just the travel part.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are a lot of people that that work with her who don't, you know, who go on some of the trips, but not all the trips. And, you know, they're usually pretty tired, too.
I imagine. Let's just switch before we go back to phone calls to Marco Rubio, who has found the perfect message. What is that message against both Jeb and Hillary?
He's the candidate of tomorrow. And, you know, what they're talking about is yesterday's news. I think this is perhaps the best single message we've heard from any of the Republicans other than Jeb Bush, because he wouldn't say something bad about himself. I think it's the most smartly crafted message in terms of taking on Jeb Bush and say, this guy's yesterday, and mm-hmm. taking on Hillary Clinton and say, she's yesterday. You know, even came very close to quoting Fleetwood Mac's Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow when he unveiled his campaign, a borrow from Bill Clinton in 1992. I think he's going to try to run the generational change campaign.
Hmm. And will that be effective? Is Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton from another? Are they both from another era? Really, should we be looking at younger people?
I think that the Clinton people have been pretty aware of this as a potential vulnerability, and my sense is that they have tried to calculate for that or tried to adjust for that. I think, you know, part of her coming out and saying she wants to end the era of mass incarceration, she wants body cameras, she wants to go further than President Obama on protecting unauthorized workers from deportation. I think all of that is part and parcel of the desire to show that she is putting something out there that's new.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think she's very well aware of it. I think Jeb Bush has had, you know, he hasn't announced for the presidency yet, so I think he's got some time to do that. But even in interviews, for instance, over the weekend, he was asked whether he would, if he would have gone into Iraq like his brother did, and he said yes. And, you know, there's sort of 12 years of wisdom between that original decision and now. He seemed pretty confident of it. There didn't seem to be a whole lot of caveating. So I think that's interesting. I think it's going to be hard for him to try to distance himself from his brother effectively and maintain a Republican base, but some of whom like the Bush years.
Mm-hmm. How old is he, Jonathan?
a great question. I believe he's 64, I could be wrong about that.
Yeah. And before we finish with Marco Rubio, and somebody may want to talk about him, you also asked if he has the chutzpah to roll the dice on Iran.
Yeah, he was considering putting up an amendment to basically it was a bill moved through Congress that would have that would give the Congress the ability to reject an Iran nuclear deal, and Rubio was thinking about bringing up an amendment that would have required Iran to recognize Israel's right to exist as part of any deal making, which of course Iran is not going to do. So it was seen as a poison pill if it went through. Kill the bill, which would have angered some of his colleagues on the Republican side who want to have that ability to take that vote. And then, you know, also even it would have angered some folks who had to kill it. What ended up happening is it didn't get offered. So he sort of got a win-win. He didn't have to actually anger a lot of his colleagues by making them take a tough vote. And at the same time, he can go around and say, I really believe that we should have put this in there.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Paul in Union, Illinois. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I wanted to respond to the woman who was talking about all of the ghosts in the closet or skeletons in the closet for the Clintons. It seems to me that there's this attitude around that the that Democrats are dirty and Republicans are squeaky clean, when in fact George H.W. Bush was involved with the Bin Laden family through Carlyle Incorporated and a BCCA, a huge international bank failure. George H.W. went to work for Bin Laden at Carlyle after he went out of office. George W., of course, was involved in, you know, any number of deals that were insider type of things, including the Medicare Part D, which he negotiated with no option for the government to negotiate with pharma companies. Of course, then there's, you know, the elephant on the table is the war in Iraq. But you know, it's not that both sides are squeaky clean. It's that the actual dollars changing hands in the case of the Bushes seems to me to be far exceed what the possibilities were for Hillary.
Jonathan.
I think if the question is whether politicians never met a buck they didn't like,
mm-hmm.
The answer is that they never met a buck they didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they use, not everybody, but by and large what you see is folks turn their service in government into a cash register. You know, in the case of the Clintons, they've done it on speaking fees. They've done it to build a foundation that pays for a lot of their travel and creature comforts. And, you know, anytime you've got that going on and you've got people giving you money who have business before the government, you're going to raise a lot of red flags. So I think, you know, that's what she has done. I think the Bush family has had all sorts of sort of questionable ties over the years. I'm not surprised by it. I think the American public is somewhat disgusted by it, but less likely to vote on it than to vote on other things.
Well, those are the people who are going to latch on to Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, right, who are very disgusted with it. My question, and I've asked this before, I'm interested in your response to it, is she is the one, though, Hillary Clinton, who is now campaigning, asking for campaign finance reform. And I wonder if you can be believable on that issue when you have the problems that she's had with with her foundation, the coziness with Wall Street. I mean, does that strike true, or do we pay closer scrutiny to her and criticize her more because it doesn't somehow seem genuine?
Yeah, I think the latter, probably. I think that somehow it doesn't seem genuine. I mean, one of the other disingenuous pieces of that is she said she wanted to back a constitutional amendment to get rid of some of the abuses of the campaign finance system. And, you know, the truth is the presidents of the United States have no role in constitutional amendments other than saying I like it or I don't like it. They don't, they don't sign those bills. You know, they are cut out of that process. So it's an easy thing to say if you're never going to have to implement it. You know, I also think that I think that whatever she saw to her as being to her advantage in campaigning and to her party's advantage in campaigning, she would embrace. And that's a multi-layered question. I mean, what benefits me versus a Republican opponent? What benefits me versus a Democratic opponent? What benefits my party long-term against Republicans? You know, there's a sort of a set of issues there that are, you know, I don't think we've heard enough from her on how she thinks about it to really deconstruct why it is she wants to do that.
And Paul, if you're still there, who are you rooting for? Paul? Well, if you want to send us an email, I'll say who you're rooting for, if you have somebody. We're going to welcome more phone calls. Jonathan Allen is our guest. It's All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. He is senior political correspondent for Vox, and he is the co-author of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we have a couple phone lines open now if you want to join our All Things Political conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And let's go to George in Rhinelander. Hi, George. Oh, George, who's calling? Hi, George.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Hi. Well, you know, I just think it's very interesting for all the talk we do about Libya and Benghazi. We don't really ever talk about the war itself in Libya, which was, if you look at the footage, you look at the international reports, it was genocide. And the only reason we were in Libya was to stop Gaddafi from starting a gold-based currency. Because when it really comes down to it, if bankers and the world community say, oh, this world leader needs to go because he's going to start some different sort of currency.
I haven't heard much about this currency issue. Let's talk a little bit about Libya, though, and talk about what's happened in the Middle East and how presidential candidates will address this. What was a time of great hope for all of these countries has turned into just one after another facing terrorism in the midst or revolt. It's just such a difficult part of the world again. Would you like to talk a little bit more, Jonathan, about Libya or pick the country of your choice?
So Libya is great. I think that this is one of the places where Republicans really have an opportunity, or at least some of them do, to be critical of Hillary Clinton's judgment. She very much made the case for going into Libya, both in the United States and around the world, help put together a coalition for stopping Gaddafi. I think she believed that there was at least a chance that the transitional Libyan government would be able to stand up and actually take control of that country. We have not seen that. I think, you know, Benghazi was a horrible tragedy, and at the same time, sort of symptomatic of the larger issue of a country being overrun by warlords and gangs. The trick for a lot of the Republicans is that most of the Republican establishment was in favor of going into Libya, so it's hard to criticize her for having poor judgment if Republicans are making the same argument.
Mm-hmm.
There are some who have positions that will play better than that. Rand Paul, for instance, who's if not isolationist, certainly more isolationist leaning than Hillary Clinton, has been kind of hitting her on the larger Libya question, and I think ultimately that's the one that has a lot more potency than Benghazi. I think you really have to stretch to be in a place where you think that Benghazi was Hillary Clinton's fault.
Mm-hmm.
There were terrorists who overran a compound. Like, the proximate cause of the four Americans' death was terrorism. And so I think most Americans will see it that way and have seen it that way. But that larger question of was it wise to go into Libya to disrupt Muammar Gaddafi and then sort of leave a chaotic mess behind, I think is one that will be discussed in the campaign.
Rand Paul, we haven't talked about him turning off Republicans, you write, by stretching the truth. He has a habit of saying things that aren't true about himself and about other Republicans. That's quite a headline.
Yeah. he says things like he wants to expand tax credits for working families, and then he votes against them on the floor. There was something, and I'm trying to recall exactly what it was. He said that at one point that Hillary Clinton was opposed to arming Syrian rebels when in fact she had been for it. He said it on Fox News a couple of times, and then his campaign finally admitted that actually he had just flubbed. It was something else he was talking about.
Hmm.
So I think, he is anxious to reach out to a lot of new voters, and I think, the danger for him in that is saying things that today that he can't keep up with tomorrow.
Hmm. And from Nathan in Milwaukee, this email, Snopes, S-N-O-P-E-S, is a website that investigates rumors, internet claims, and so on. It found the claim that Hillary was fired from Watergate to be false and even discussed who claimed it.
Yeah, it's not something I was particularly aware of, actually, I must confess.
Let's go to Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, I give you my campaign finance riddle. What's the difference between Congress and a brothel?
I don't know, Steve. What's the difference?
I hope it's a clean answer.
And if you don't know, and I don't know, and we don't know, what can be done about it and what will be done about it?
Jonathan.
My view is that one of the things that could be done to really alter the landscape is to stop letting politicians give each other unlimited amounts of campaign funds. So what happens in Congress is Nancy Pelosi or John Boehner will raise $1 million. They'll turn that over to the party committee that will then spend it on all these other candidates. And what it does is has the effect of reinforcing the power that these congressional leaders have, which I think kind of warps the way votes are taken in the House and Senate. And I think one of the things you could do is take away that power. And actually, I'd be in favor of bringing back, I imagine I'll be stoned by some of the listeners for saying this, come back with an earmark system that works, that's hard to corrupt, and actually get legislators to start trading horses that way instead of with campaign money.
It's so much money, isn't it, Jonathan? It's just, so
yeah,
much.
I mean, maybe it's good for the economy.
Right. It's good for TV stations. Come on. Good for the economy. Who else gets the money? Thanks, Steve, for the call. Brian in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Republicans, obviously, are not going to vote for Hillary. And so then it becomes either swing voters or Democrats. And who knows about the swing voters, but amongst Democrats, are enough men going to vote for Clinton?
Why wouldn't they, Brian?
Just because of the gender bias that still is prevalent.
Oh, okay. Jonathan?
Yeah, I think, out of the Democratic constituencies, I think straight white liberal men like Hillary Clinton the least. Because she does well with African Americans, she does well with Latinos, she does well with the lesbian and gay community, she does well with women of all colors and ethnic backgrounds. So I do think that's a question for her. Can she get these guys that don't like her to vote for her? I'm not sure what that looks like, other than to say, the reliance on white men has not been, as voters, has not been particularly effective for Mitt Romney or John McCain. So, you really have to run up the score there if you're a Republican and talking about the white male vote.
And what's the basis of the not liking her?
I don't know. I think it's one of the great questions of all time. and I may write about it soon. But clearly when you look at polling, she seems to do very well with, there's this belief that she does poorly with liberals within the Democratic Party. She actually does better with liberals than she does with self-identified moderates in the Democratic Party. But I think one of the reasons there's this thought about that is the white men in the Democratic Party tend to have pretty, pretty loud bullhorns, and so a lot of them are writers and television commentators, and I think you start to get this sort of warped impression of how the Democratic Party views Hillary Clinton.
Hmm. Thanks very much for your call, Brian. And Jonathan, thanks for being with us, even though you don't feel well and your son doesn't feel well and it's raining, and take a nap.
Yeah, I'm going to try to do that. It's my pleasure to be on with you. Thank you,
Jonathan. A pleasure to have you, as always. Senior political correspondent for Vox. He also worked at Bloomberg as Washington Bureau Chief. He was at Politico and at Congressional Quarterly. And he's the co-author of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to KP for doing on-air production here in Milwaukee as well. Please post your pictures of the pets you love, and we'll talk about why you love them. What is it scientifically we can learn, what has science learned about that bond between human beings and their animals? It's pretty phenomenal. And we want to see your pictures, okay? Thank you. News is coming up.